Hi, this is Pep Phelan here from the Poach Centre at Melbourne University, and I have with me today Aurora Milroy. How are you doing, Aurora?
I'm pretty good, Pep. How are you?
Excellent, thank you. So, Aurora, tell me more about yourself. So, your profession, where you're from, and your background.
So, I'm a Belgu woman. My family are from the Pilbara region of Western Australia. I grew up on Noongar country though in Fremantle, and I'm actually back here at the moment for coronavirus lockdown. So that's actually a nice change to have some good sunny weather. My profession, I think we talked about this before, but it's a sort of nebulous, unknown professional area. So I am the manager at the Indigenous Knowledge Institute. So the Indigenous Knowledge Institute was launched in August last year by the Vice-Chancellor Duncan Maskell. And basically I started in March, and the kind of role is about setting up this institute to recognise Indigenous knowledge systems and advance research and education in Indigenous knowledge, and to work in better partnerships with Indigenous knowledge holders. So I've got a kind of policy background in terms of my studies, and I've worked in government for a couple of years and at a school of government as well. So that's kind of my background and my area of interest.
So what was the pathway that you took to get to where you currently are now?
It's kind of a straight pathway in a sense, but also because I've kind of stuck with this generalist approach, it's been a bit of a just see what comes up in terms of the career trajectory. I think I sort of listened to some of the other podcasts you had, and I think, you know, a lot of the journeys that people have talked about so far are these really interesting ones into education. And people have come from quite interesting backgrounds, or have worked first, or hadn't really thought about higher education. For me, my mum works in higher ed, so it was quite an easy path into higher ed. It was an expected path. And I think for me, what that really shows is the power of having someone who's been through the system before. My mum was first in our family really to go to university, and then she's worked in that space, and so for me it wasn't really a question and it was just a natural pathway. So I studied history, I did Russian history, and I did law, and then I sort of had a kind of moment at the end of that, and I tried to pick degrees that would take a long time to study because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with a career, and obviously still don't, which is why paths are kind of quite general. Yeah, I sort of had this moment towards the end of that. I was doing my history honours, was thinking about what the next step for that would be, and someone said, you know, have you thought about policy? Your legal, or my law dissertation was more in a policy space. And so I guess obviously highly suggestible as I was did a Masters of Public Policy. And then I worked at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet for a couple of years in a graduate position. So I worked in, you know, Indigenous affairs, but I also worked in the cabinet team and in some other policy areas, and decided that was a very useful skill set, but not an area that I wanted to keep working in because it was quite bureaucratic, obviously, as a government organisation. And then, so I moved to the Australia New Zealand School of Government and working more in the kind of interface between higher education and government and focusing a bit on Indigenous strategy and programs and events. So that was a really great role, and then moved into this Indigenous Knowledge Institute in March. So basically I've just seen good jobs come up and have followed them, and this role is for 5 years, so we'll see what happens at the end of that one.
Yeah, I mean, you do incredible work too, so, you know, don't sell yourself short.
Thanks, Pep.
So what motivates you to be your best every day, and what are the values you bring to your work?
Well, at the moment, there's not a lot that's motivating me. It's a very weird place to be in with the lockdown, and also coming into a new role right at this time when things are really difficult, feeling kind of a bit disconnected. But I think what mostly brought me to this role as well was the fact that the University of Melbourne has some really amazing Indigenous networks, researchers, academics, professional staff. And I think for me, what motivates me is getting to work with smart, motivated mob who are doing cool things. And so, yeah, in some ways, I suppose what motivates me every day is the fact that if I kind of stopped, I might fall apart completely. But also the fact that, you know, there's a lot to build on and there's really exciting momentum and goodwill. And I think that's really often hard to find. You know, you can have really good ideas, but if other people are shutting you down or, you know, aren't behind it or investing in it or wanting to do stuff, then the ideas are kind of worthless. But there's some really great initiatives, including the Posh Centre and the leadership and all the team there who are doing great work. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to grow and to set up this institute. In terms of what values I bring to my work, I think Indigenous people tend to work in a very, very different way to non-Indigenous people. That's not, you know, always the case, but I do think that when I've worked with mob, it feels different. And I think what I've also noticed is that when you're working with mob and you explain some of the ways you work, you see other kind of groups of people start to come out and say, well, that's my preferred way of working too. In a previous role, we would talk about relationality as a way of working, and that's kind of saying, well, we've got to check in and we've got to be able to defend everything we do to our communities, and we have to talk to people first. And so by the time you're coming to make a decision, you've actually already talked to everyone, and so you're all on the same page, and it's just this formal thing, as opposed to using the meeting as the decision-making moment. After sort of talking through those kind of ideas, you hear Chinese colleagues or Indian colleagues saying, well, actually that's how we would do things too, and we try and do this kind of, the relationship is the important thing, without necessarily having to have an objective to a meeting. The relationship, the meeting, the getting to know each other is the objective. So I think that value is really important to me, the space to just actually have conversations, to meet people, to know who everyone is and for everyone to know who you are and how the system all fits together is important. I guess another kind of personal value and another one that lots of Blackfellas have is honesty. I think I try and be as direct as possible with people, and you know, we can't actually deliver all the time. And I think rather than pretend that we can deliver on everything, just to say this is what we want to try, we could fail, but we are going to try. And, you know, if you do mess something up, to just say, yeah, I like fucked that up, sorry. You know, I think the ability to be really honest in processes is important, and I value it in my relationships with other people. Yeah, even if it's kind of brutal, it's nice to actually hear. But it's not normally brutal, right? Like, if you've got the relationship side of things right and you are touching base all the time and you have trust in that relationship, then honesty is also an easy thing to have too.
So you've worked in a number of places, and you've obviously you've been to school both in Australia and elsewhere. What were you doing over at Oxford?
Yeah, I studied a Master of Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford. So that was a one-year coursework master's.
So in all of your education and your work experience, and also watching people in your life, you know, your mum and all of the people surrounding her, particularly in higher ed areas and leadership areas, what have you learned about influence, impact and leadership from the work that you do?
I think influence to me is almost the most important thing. And it goes back to those relationships. So particularly in a policy space, and I think this is about the connection too between higher ed and policy, is that there are often these different beasts that don't really communicate with each other and don't know what each other does. So universities produce research, but is that demand driven? You know, is that something that government wants? And in the same time, government wants quick turnaround on answers, but not necessarily evidence-based documents or policy. So what's the middle ground of bridging those two in order to say that research has influence and, you know, policy has influence and impact on the ground by bringing people together and opening up conversation. So I think the more relationships that we have between institutions, sectors, and that's sort of those are, you know, academia and government places that I've worked, but also how do we bring communities into that too in the conversation, because we're often talking a different talk, or we just don't know what people are interested in or after because these are different kind of systems. But how do we build the relationships and the bridges between those systems in order to get everyone understanding, and then we can kind of efficiently move towards something that has impact and influence? All the kind of influence I've seen, I mean, number one, it's about those relationships. But I would say also people who just get on and do things too have a lot of impact, rather than you'll meet a lot of people who'll talk about their big plans for something or this great scheme to do something. And I think they often get a lot of backing and interest and everyone gets excited. But if you haven't actually achieved anything or done the plan, talking about it is just one thing. And the people, I think, who have achieved a lot have kind of been a bit quieter about it and waited. And maybe it's this kind of Indigenous like shame thing of not wanting to promote what you're going to do in case it fails. But I think some of the greatest achievements we've had in Indigenous affairs have been through people who've just done things and then later said, oh yeah, that was a bit good, wasn't it? rather than trying to talk about it in advance.
What does Indigenous leadership mean to you, and how does it vary from sort of Western style leadership?
Yeah, I still do really struggle with the word leadership. It feels this kind of like icky Western way of doing things and of framing things. And I think it is because of that, what I was sort of talking about before, it's linked to this idea of self-promotion and it's linked to this individual concept, which is so alien to an Indigenous way of doing things. I actually had a conversation with a friend probably a year or so ago. We were talking about this person we knew who had been kind of doing quite a lot of self-promotion. And I think my friend said, can't he just be a bit shame like every other black fella and not talk about all the things he's doing? And I think, although, you know, we shouldn't feel ashamed of the stuff that we're doing and achieving, I think there's something in that in an Indigenous system is about, well, we're actually a team and we're a system, and that's success and that's impact. You know, it's about all of the pieces that work together to achieve something, and it's about no particular individual. And I think, so I heard Simone Charisse interview, and she talked about that too, that for her, leadership from an Indigenous model is about often, you know, leading side by side or leading even from behind. I had like a big interview for Oxford, and one of the questions was, are leaders born or made or something like that? And I felt answering the question, it was this very strange one, and I tried to talk through my notion of leadership being about the impact that you have. And so the people who I think are leaders are probably never going to be kind of acknowledged or recognised. But, you know, say at my old university at UWA, the number of kind of Indigenous doctors and Indigenous lawyers who've come out of there is huge. And, you know, the people who've worked on that don't really have any recognition for what they've done. And they're just kind of in the back working tirelessly. And that to me is leadership, because it's about, you know, working really hard and diligently to achieve an outcome that's really positive, and about achieving other people's or contributing to other people's, you know, pathway and journey and their kind of elevation to something that they want. So that kind of facilitative role, I think, is a form of leadership, particularly when you can have impact. And I think for me, an Indigenous approach to leadership is about working together. It sounds a bit cliche, but it is. It's about the kind of systems that bolster you and make you feel stronger. And, you know, I think in recent years, I've become a lot more confident to try things and to have a go at expressing ideas and doing things, because of feeling there's this kind of support network around you who also put the ideas in, and, you know, never trying to say, well, I had this idea, because you never really had the idea. It's just saying you've heard a little bit from this person, a little bit from that person, and you're bringing together all of these pre-existing ideas and conversations and just putting them together or putting them out there. I still think leadership's an odd concept. The more we move towards kind of systems approaches and saying, you know, how do we understand our role in a system and understand that whatever we produce was kind of there before and we're just kind of putting the pieces together. But how do we actually achieve impact and influence, as you said, through those relationships and those actions?
It's a vastly different model, really. Trying to get those two systems to work together often is, well, you really can't. You really can't, can you?
There's hope, Pep. I don't know what you're talking about.
So in what ways do you believe that non-Indigenous people, either friends or colleagues, can learn about leadership from Indigenous people regarding the ways of doing, being and knowing?
I think it's a really challenging one. And, you know, in the same way that, you know, Indigenous approaches are based in systems and collectives and things like that, you know, there is this really, really well-established Western system of doing things. And I think the tendency of Western approaches is to want to listen and take something from an Indigenous system to apply it within the system without breaking down the whole system itself or without having a conversation between systems. So sure, you can keep, we're not saying, I mean, I do think Indigenous systems are better, but I'm not necessarily saying that as my biased point of view from an Indigenous system. But, you know, how do we say it's not about one assimilating another or one extracting another or a hierarchy of knowledge or systems of doing things, but how do we actually have them on equal footing to have a conversation? And right now in Australia, I think it's really hard because it's all based around this Western system and the room to let new conversations in is really small. It's sort of granting you saying, you know, well, we'll let you talk about it in this field. We'll apply it to the way we run a meeting, or we'll apply it to one small aspect of our overarching system. And it just drowns because, you know, it's not pieces of information. It's not broken down. It's a whole system and a holistic way of doing things. So you need to actually be really open to the conversation there. Sure, I think it starts with non-Indigenous people listening to Indigenous people and points of view, but also reflecting on what the foundations of their system are. So reflecting on, you know, what's your position? What are your values? And it's okay to have different values, but you have to articulate and realise what they are rather than assuming that they are everyone's or that they're the status quo. You know, recognising that you are in a system of bias and there's no such thing as your kind of neutral objective point of view. I think that's kind of a starting point, is listening and reflecting on the self. And then I think kind of in terms of how you move forward with that, I do think Indigenous people, we are leading stuff and we're trying to do it for ourselves as well. We're also waiting for you to kind of, or for non-Indigenous people to be ready or to catch up, you know, in a sense, and say, you know, it's not for us to constantly be telling non-Indigenous people to recognise us. We recognise ourselves and we have to just focus on our journey. And when non-Indigenous people are ready to come to the table, then I think we'd be happy for a conversation that was more on equal footing.
What do you think are the greatest barriers for Indigenous people within the systems that you work in, so education, government sort of systems?
There's a lot. I think numbers is actually a huge one. You know, we are 3% of the population. You know, even if an organisation had 3% representation, which most of them don't in terms of staff, how do we actually have enough of a voice to have influence? You know, we're not at the most senior levels for a start, often employed in lower levels. And even regardless, 3% is so low. The same is in the government space as well. You know, we've got such low representation, and even proportional representation is really, really small. A Māori public servant who I had worked with in my previous role said, you know, there's not enough of us to go around. It would be great to have Māori leadership in, you know, every organisation, but we have to face facts that as a numbers game, that's not going to happen. And so we need to change the culture of the organisations and get non-Indigenous people to also lead this change. So having just said, you know, we're waiting for non-Indigenous people to come to the table, I do think there's a really important role to start your own journey on that and to think about what your influence is. You know, the majority of people in an organisation are non-Indigenous and in leadership roles is non-Indigenous. So you have to be really wanting to develop your own Indigenous leadership as a non-Indigenous person. And I don't mean that in terms of taking, you know, an Indigenous space or taking up that role, but saying, you know, what does it mean to think about those things and to drive a culture of change as well?
How do we transition workplaces to start to employ Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals into roles, not Indigenous roles, but just roles?
I mean, this is another one. So I guess actually going back to the previous question as well, the other kind of big barrier that we have is this qualification issue, where we deem the qualifications needed to succeed in government or higher education are, you know, the PhD or the 10 years work experience in a leadership role or whatever it might be, which Indigenous people haven't had access to. And so we're still holding Indigenous people to account to a standard that is set by non-Indigenous people, you know, which Indigenous people have been excluded from for years and years. So I think that's a huge barrier. In terms of how to get Indigenous people into roles around the university, that will come with time. I do genuinely think that as we start to do sort of affirmative measures to get people in, then we've got enough baseline to cover all of the, you know, quote, Indigenous stuff, and can then move people into other roles of expertise. But I'd also say, like, it is an ongoing question or challenge about the mainstream versus Indigenous role. You know, I kind of thought for a while I want to be in a mainstream kind of role because I have all these skills, but sort of when you end up doing it, it's really boring. And, you know, I'm not, you know, and it's not like going to be the same for everyone. But for me, I think I had this realization that, no, I really do want to work in Indigenous affairs because that is the area that interests me and the area that I'm passionate about. And I know that's not everyone's journey, but I think also assuming that Indigenous affairs kind of pigeonholes people is also problematic because we're not given the opportunity, or we're made to feel bad about being in it, like we're lesser, you know, like, oh, you've taken a role because it's Indigenous and you're Indigenous and therefore it's easy. When these are really challenging issues and made even more challenging by all your personal relationships and all the kind of other expectations and obligations you have. So, yeah, I think if people really want those roles, it will come. And I think also, I think institutional culture is something that has to change too, because even if you are in a mainstream role, if you're an Indigenous person, you will always be dragged into organising NAIDOC Week or Reconciliation Week or one of those things, or doing answering all the Indigenous kind of questions. So, you know, giving people the freedom to choose their roles, whether that's an Indigenous role, a mainstream role, but also kind of recognising that it is a really long journey, is hard. And maybe we need more Indigenous established institutions to start giving those roles where you can just focus on what you want to focus on.
Yeah. People don't often talk about those additional burdens which are placed upon Indigenous people, where they actually have to be the question answerer, be the organiser for NAIDOC Week, be the exemplary for all Indigenous people that have ever existed on this continent. You know, like there's just no understanding that for some people in a role, whether it's Indigenous identified or not, there's a role with particular tasks and orientations that need to be undertaken. So much of their time is spent doing stuff outside of that role just purely on the fact that they're Indigenous.
Yeah. And there's also, I mean, not just like what the expectations of the institution puts on you, but also the institution doesn't recognise all the work that you're doing behind the scenes with community and other people to make sure that the stuff you do isn't going horribly wrong. So because that might not be the way that they would approach a role or conceive of a role. So it's always much, much bigger than the actual position description says. And I think that's often, poorly recognised.
I did want to ask you this question, considering you've got a major role in the new Indigenous Knowledges Institute. So the terms decolonise and indigenise are being utilised more often and more commonly. You know, there's been some work going on over in the UK for quite a while. It's just starting to seep into vernacular here. What do they mean to you? And what do you think the best approach is and why?
I think these probably have like highly technical meanings, which I am not across because, as I said, I'm not an academic, I'm a policy person, and I only kind of skim the surface on everything. But I think they're both really important. So I think decolonisation is about dismantling what we have. So trying to undo some of the colonial project, you know, and I think that's a hard one. So how do we get an institution that exists to think a different way? Because I think we're never going to have the same amount of power or the people or the numbers, as I said before, to really push our own agenda. And we are, as much as it's difficult to say, you know, reliant on these institutions that were set up through colonization. And so how do we adapt them, break down some of their mindsets, some of their behaviours, some of their practices, which are colonial, to make them better functioning institutions for us? So that's the kind of decolonisation side to me. And then indigenisation is really about building from scratch. So decolonisation is a deconstruction of a system, and indigenisation is saying, how do we think about things in an Indigenous way? So how do we think about the concept of education in an Indigenous way and then build something around that, so something new that is an Indigenous form. And it still in conversation with colonization in the West, because it's about kind of thinking about an Indigenous way to approach something Western, so like education or some other kind of system or approach, or, you know, what is Indigenous mathematics or Indigenous science or Indigenous things like that. So it's still somewhat in conversation, but it's more about taking that Western concept as a starting point and saying, what is our Indigenous approach to this? And really thinking outside the box. So I think that's the more exciting space to work in, because you're not kind of stuck with all the kind of problematic cultural changes that you want to achieve, but you're thinking about creating new things and exciting futures for people which are Indigenous-led and from an Indigenous point of view. And I think, yeah, some of that work might happen in existing institutions. I think it's quite hard. A lot of it happens from Indigenous people working together and with allies to develop new systems and approaches. I always think about Indigenisation in this sort of sense of, I watched a documentary a while ago on the Native American influence on rock music. And I just always remember this quote. I think it was Jimi Hendrix's sister who said to him, you know, something like, you've got to do it in the Indian way. And that's how you've got to play music. You've got to do it in the Indian way. And for me, that's what Indigenization is about. Like, we've got to do it in the Aboriginal way. And what is that? And stop thinking about ourselves always in relation to the frameworks or what we're being offered by non-Indigenous society and government, but to say, what are the things we actually want and how do we achieve those? They both go together, and I think, you know, they're both problematic and people have points of view about them, but I do think they have a role about constructing an Indigenous future.
What does allyship mean to you, and what are the skill sets, knowledges and behaviours that you believe make a really good ally?
I think sort of going back to kind of that question about, you know, the role of non-Indigenous people in cultural shifts, it's that same thing. It's about making sure that as an ally you're reflective of yourself and your role and the system that has created you. And I think also kind of listening to, you know, what Indigenous people say, but also recognising the nuance in that, not just always, you know, because there's so much diversity in Indigenous communities. So being able to listen widely and kind of think about how you want to act based on those things. But allyship is just really, I think, mostly about platforming others and making sure that you don't become central to the space. So it's the same as in feminism, you know, it's great to have male allies, but they don't need to be the feminists that we aren't, and taking up that space to talk about things. So I think non-Indigenous allies are great to use any power systems that they have to bring our voices out, but ultimately it needs to be our voices out there who are getting heard. I also think there's a role for Indigenous people to ensure that we are allies for each other. And I think this is something that often gets overlooked, and particularly for people in really privileged positions. So, you know, I'm Indigenous, but I am in a very, very privileged position. And you would have heard that I had a very, very privileged kind of pathway through education. My story is kind of not the same story as everyone else. And I think trying to kind of pretend like it is really problematic. And we need to be there for people who've had different journeys or have different struggles or who have vastly different opinions to us. And I think making sure that we're always trying to platform the voices of our mob who don't get heard as much is an important ally role for us as well.
Absolutely. What is your unique vision for Indigenous people, both locally and around the world? What would you like to see happen?
That is a tricky question, Pep. Given I don't even have foresight about, you know, what I'll do in my own life in kind of 2 weeks or whatever. I just, you know, I think it's fairly basic. I just think that I want to see us leading our own journey. And I think a lot of the time, you know, even with kind of discussions around constitutional recognition, treaty, we end up getting sort of stuck, Native Title, all of these things, stuck in our relationship with wanting the state to recognise us in some way. And ultimately, that's not where our success is going to come from. And we're never going to get the level of recognition that we want. So I think for me, if we can sort of have a shift where you know, we, and I think Daryl Rigney talks about this, you know, to be sovereign, you have to act sovereign. No one can give you sovereignty. And so I think seeing, you know, Indigenous communities charting their own course, doing what we want is amazing. And I think, you know, that's kind of where I want to see us going, in a place where we do have more support or more ability to use our Indigenous knowledge systems and to sustain those and to make that a really integral part of our culture and society will be something that I would really like to see. And I think, you know, that sort of lots of communities have really, really strong culture and cultural practices. But, you know, the, I guess, negotiation between what success you're going to get in the West and, you know, all those kind of things, questions you have to do and compromises you have to make about your culture versus your education or other things as well. I'd like to see less of that kind of compromise or negotiation and the ability to just actually be really strong in both, and to continue communities and have communities leading education that's kind of about Indigenous knowledge and your culture and your history and your stories, but also giving you skills to succeed and to do things in the Western world if you want to as well.
Thank you so much. It was amazing to talk to you and to hear all of your fantastic insights.
Thanks, Pep.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.